From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A tragic school shooting with nightmarish echoes of Columbine has shocked a Minnesota Indian tribe and the nation this week. On Monday, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss opened fire at Red Lake High School in northern Minnesota. He had already killed his grandfather and his grandfather's girlfriend when he shot to death a security guard, a teacher, and five fellow students on Monday afternoon. Then he killed himself. Today, as the first wakes begin in Red Lake, tribal officials have spoken of their community's sorrow and turned inward to grieve and heal. Tribal elder Dennis Banks said at a prayer vigil this week, "The deaths of the students stripped the community of people who might one day have been its leaders." In the age of Columbine, the whole country shares the pain and fear of Red Lake. Tonight on Point, Red Lake mourning its dead and the country struggling to understand school shootings. We begin tonight in Bemidji, Minnesota, 30 miles south of the Red Lake Reservation. Molly Marone is editor of the Bemidji Pioneer and has been reporting on the shooting and its aftermath. Molly Marone, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
It must have been a week like no other in your career, I'm guessing there, Molly.
It's been a long week. It's been tough, especially because I know a lot of the people involved. I cover the Red Lake, and they're our neighbors.
And today, the first wakes, you were at one of them, a wake for Chase Lucier. What's the mood? What's the message you're hearing?
Well, some of the mood is relief that the national media has coiled up their extension cords and gone home. The wakes are times when people cry, pray, but they also eat. And there's meals all the time, and they play cards, and they smoke, and they chat about other things. They're kind of a time to relax. The wakes are traditionally 3 days long because, according to traditional Indian beliefs, it's a three-day journey to the spirit world.
And when you're at the wake, is it clearly, identifiably, a Chippewa wake? Is it a Christian wake? Is it a mixture of the two?
Well, it depends upon the individuals. Chase's is kind of a mixture. He is laid out in a casket with the top of it open, but and a Pendleton blanket spread across, a brightly colored blanket, and in the casket he's holding tobacco in his hands. His school sports jersey is tacked on the lid, on the inside lid of the casket. Those are some of the outside the community center where the wake is, his wake is being held. There's a watch fire that friends and family will keep watch over and keep burning, tending for 3 days until the funeral. On the other hand, his funeral will be at St. Mary's Catholic Mission Church down the road about a mile from the community center, and Father Pat Sullivan will officiate.
Molly, we know, sadly, that there's nothing nothing unique to the Red Lake Reservation in terms of this kind of horrible thing happening. It has famously happened elsewhere and happened repeatedly, but we want to understand this environment. You know the area so well, and many of us do not. Just the context. First, just the environment. Paint a picture for us. This reservation is on the shore of an enormous lake, Red Lake. I used to know the territory, that sort of the lake territory in northern Minnesota from childhood, but I don't know the area right around Red Lake. What is it? Is it heavily forested? Is it rolling country? What's it look like?
It's flat and forested. It's a land of pines and birches. There are about 5,000 people living on this big reservation, and that's about half the enrollment of the Red Lake Nation. Others, the other half, live in Bemidji or Chicago or Washington, D.C., or wherever they have jobs and things. And
that's 5,000 on 850,000 acres or so. Do people concentrate around the school?
Yes, there are three communities. Red Lake Village, where the school is the the biggest. I'm not sure how many people live there, a few mm-hmm. hundred. And then there's a little community called Little Rock, a few miles to the east, and then a little community called Ridby, 5 miles to the west. And then if you can imagine upper and lower Red Lake, it's a one big lake, but there's a narrows, and on the peninsula in the narrows halfway between the north and south ends of the lake, there's another small community of Ponema.
60% unemployment, we read, casinos, but they haven't been a big boon. Mm-hmm. Almost unique, just one other reservation in the country where private land ownership is not permitted. It's all communally held.
Yes.
And a fairly tight-knit, almost closed community, if I read it right.
That's right. People are, well, as somebody said, there isn't anyone here who isn't related at least as close as cousin to one of those who's died. So people are very family-oriented. They're very aware of their extended family. As I was just talking to this Judy Roy, the tribal secretary, a little bit ago, because she had wanted me to save some newspapers for her. Mm. And we were talking, and she was saying, you know, I had to kind of reprimand the governor. She was meeting with the governor mm-hmm. last week because he was referring to the unemployment and to the poverty and things like that. And mm-hmm. she said there's no question that they are economically challenged, but she said that she objected to being called poor. Mm-hmm. They are very rich in many ways, in family, in the fact that they can count on each other to support them in hard times, that they have a rich culture and heritage.
And tight-knit or closed as they may be, very clearly this week, they're also part of a national culture that comes right in by the television, by the Internet.
That was very hard for them. They and many of the national media are very aggressive, did not educate themselves or consider that not only are they entering a place of mourning, they're entering a very rural area where people aren't used to outsiders, and it wouldn't have to be an Indian reservation. Mm-hmm. It could be a small town in Iowa or something, mm-hmm. but a place where everybody knows everyone, and having cameras focused on you and microphones stuck under your chin when all you can do is think about the babies that you've lost was very intrusive. The tribal chairman on Tuesday, when the great media masses arrived.
This is Floyd Jourdain.
Yes, Chairman Floyd Jourdain mm-hmm, Jr. Mm-hmm. Issued a statement that we're a closed reservation. Non-members who wish to do business on the reservation require a business permit. I'm reading part of it.
Mm-hmm. And journalists have been thrown off the reservation this week.
Some have, because he required that the media stay in the parking lot of the new jail. It's the criminal justice complex, and
that's a pretty tight circle.
Pardon me?
That's a pretty tight circle. Molly, on Monday, as I understand it, you were the first news person on the scene within an hour or so of the shootings. What did you find?
Yeah, I guess that's right. Well, this chills me to tell you, but we got a hang-up call from a kid about 3 o'clock or just a little bit after, so, and it, a quavery call, and I was on another line, but the receptionist came trotting back to my office and stuck a note under my nose saying, shooting at Red Lake High School. And
that'll get your attention.
Yes, it did. My belief is that this young person was calling from the school.
For help.
But yes, for help. A lot of them, you know, kids all have cell phones.
Sure.
And many of them called 911, but one of them called the newspaper, which I thought was really interesting.
When you got, of course, 3 p.m. was just the time when Jeff Weiss was on his rampage. What did you find when you arrived an hour later?
I arrived when they were doing the evacuation. They were getting the kids out of the school, and they were having them walk over to a government building about a block away where school buses were routed to pick them up and take them home, or they were waiting for their parents.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the kids were still standing around in the schoolyard or on the highway or the road. It's not a road. Blacktop Road, by the school, and just bewildered and weeping in shock. And I talked to many of the youngsters, and I got basically three reactions. The boys that I talked to, obviously, you know, they looked as if they had been crying or wanted to cry, and they would just turn away and walk. They couldn't speak. And then there were some, and these were girls, just wanted to, you know, lean on somebody and cry, and so I would hug them and let them cry on me. And then there were some that wanted to talk and tell what happened, and they would, and they just, this is what I heard, this is what I saw, this is where I was.
Molly, you and I just have a minute left. Let me ask you, do you think, you know it well, that there's something singular about this community that led to this, or do you see this as straight up part of a national fabric?
Oh, no, this isn't an American Indian issue. This is a national issue. This is very much like the Columbine business. This was a young man who had, he had suffered from depression. He had suicidal thoughts. He had been in treatment.
His father had committed suicide. His mother was in a nursing home.
Yeah. We probably will never know why he did this, but there are, now the research shows he was a subscriber to a hate website and did violent cartoons. He was a loner, but it wasn't for lack of, I mean, this is a small school. All the kids that I've talked to said, oh yeah, we talked to him. Or
he was part of America.
Strange.
Molly Marone, I know I have to let you go. It's so good of you to be with us tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Molly Marone, editor of the Bemidji Pioneer. She's been reporting on the Red Lake shootings. We're talking about them tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Red Lake, mourning its dead, and the nation struggling to make sense of school shootings. You can join the conversation tonight. What can be done to stop more Columbines, more Red Lakes? Can you believe that this has happened again? Or do you assume it will happen again and again? What is driving American children to kill each other? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear a little later in this hour from Kent Smith, professor of Indian Studies at Bemidji State University. It's located at the center of three reservations, the White Earth, the Leech Lake, and the Red Lake. But we're joined right now from New York City by Catherine Newman. She's professor of sociology at Princeton University, author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Catherine Newman, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And we're joined from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you with us.
Hello, Tom.
Catherine Newman, we're trying to see what's singular and what's part of a nationalist, tragic, horrifying national pattern here. You've written in great depth about this phenom. And I understand you feel you almost saw the pattern played out to a T in Red Lake this week. How have you taken on board what happened there?
Yes, I felt like I was reading a section out of my own book, which was published a year ago. The details are so similar to the cases that my research team studied, from the kind of location where it took place to the sorts of signals that something horrible was coming to the reactions of the community in the aftermath. There's very little about this that I find surprising as much as I find it tragic.
So tell us, what of the structure looked so familiar to you?
The first thing that's familiar, Tom, is the kind of location. School shootings of this sort typically happen in isolated rural towns where young men who feel socially marginal and are entering these deep depressions come to feel as though it's sort of a life sentence because they are so geographically isolated. If they're not doing well with their peers, they can't see the possibility of escape. These are often residentially very stable communities. They are the kinds of places people feel very attached to. And if you're doing well socially, they're wonderful places to raise kids. But if you're on the margins, you feel that you're a million miles from anywhere that you could find a group that's compatible. And it comes to feel a little bit like a jail sentence.
Jeff Weiss was reportedly sort of fit this pattern, not a top of the social pyramid kid, kind of a loner, and then all this familiar garb, the goth, clothing, the eyeliner even sometimes, the outsider looking in profile.
I think we need to be careful about this because in the research we did, we discovered that it's rarely the case that it's really a loner. Instead, I would say that kids like Jeff are failed joiners, and there's a difference. Mm. A loner is someone who absents themselves from the social world. A failed joiner is someone whose social experience is one of constant friction and rejection, and that is a different kind of character than a real loner. Mm-hmm. As far as the goth element is concerned, I think we tend to misconstrue this as well. Of course, there are thousands of kids attracted to trench coats and black fingernail polish, sure. And they are often actually the high-functioning, intelligent boys in the school who find it difficult to fit into the jock culture. And so they turn to the goth culture as an alternative that's sort of rejecting the mainline football cheerleader element. So I don't think we have a tremendous amount to fear from goth culture. It looks very oppositional and perhaps violent to those of us on the outside. But I think on the inside, for most kids, it's another group to belong to when you feel you can't fit into the absolute mainstream. Now, shooters are frequently attracted to this goth culture because they see in it a rejection of those who have rejected them.
And in the failed joiner, as you describe, not a loner, but a failed joiner, what determines? There are plenty of failed joiners in the world, sadly, but not that many that get a gun and go on a rampage, to use the word from your book, in a school. What pushes some young people to that horrific extreme?
Well, we have to understand that these kids are often in the early stages of undiagnosed severe mental disorders. In his case, we do know that he had received some psychiatric treatment, and I am sure we will hear more about this in the days to come. Among the shooters we studied, there was no treatment, no identification of them as people suffering from extreme depression, but the psychiatric reports after the fact show a very clear trail of suicidal ideation, of extreme depression. But, it, you know, in fairness, it's difficult to identify the onset of a disease like schizophrenia, for example, when you're looking at a 13-year-old. We do know what that looks like in someone who's 22, and by the time they get to be 22, if they live that long, very often these symptoms flare up and become quite recognizable. But in the early phases, it's very difficult to detect, and because the kids know there's something wrong with them, they go to enormous lengths to hide how troubled they are. So there's very little on the surface that would help us track these kids in advance. If you were paying attention to the websites where he was posting these murderous essays and drawings, then you would have seen someone who was in severe trouble. But who monitors the website of every high school kid in America? No one does. And so it's our resources for identifying these kids in advance are very weak, and I don't think that's where the solution lies at all.
As you say, he was on kind of neo-Nazi websites, maybe more than one. He was drawing grotesque sort of cartoons in school, showing them around with Nazi swastika symbols on the hats of his characters, and one in particular described in many news reports with the caption saying, "We will march until our boots are full of blood." I mean, this sounds like some huge cry for help, but it didn't get seen or interpreted that way, at least as far as we know.
I think we're going to find that the school actually did take quite a few steps, in fact, practically all the steps that were available to them. It is a very unusual act to remove a child from a school and essentially order them to be homeschooled.
And this had been done with Jeff Weiss.
This had been done. So in fairness to the schools, I think we must recognize the repertoire of options they have are fairly limited. I'm sure we're going to discover that they did try to provide counseling. In all the school shootings we looked at where there was an egregious trail of acting out, schools do step up to the plate. But the fact of the matter is most of the time there is no such trail. Most of the time school shooters are not the kids who are egregious troublemakers who come up on everybody's radar screen. And the ones who do, the schools take the actions they can. Kip Kingle in Oregon, who is very similar, I think, to Jeff Weiss,
Remind us of that case.
Kip Kingle killed his parents, went to the school and shot up the school, killed a number of kids in the school. He had been on everybody's radar screen. The school had expelled him. His parents attempted to get every kind of treatment they could, and they were one day away from having him involuntarily committed. And unfortunately, that was just one day too late. But the school had taken the actions that were available to them. We don't practice preventative detention. Mm-hmm. These are not people who've committed crimes up to this point. So the options for the school, unfortunately, are rather limited. And I think we're going to discover they had done more or less what they thought they could. They couldn't see a school shooter coming. No one sees them coming. What they can see is a kid who's having trouble. And very often it's not someone who's in academic trouble. If you look at Jeff Weiss's writings, you will see a degree of grace and power in his writing that is extremely unusual for a boy his age. Mm. You will see on his website that he is quoting from All Quiet on the Western Front. This is not a typical reading of a 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. This is a high-functioning kid. You look at these cartoons he drew and you can see an artist at work. It's tragic that it went off in this direction, but this is not your loser, kid with a low-functioning IQ. It actually looks to me like the opposite.
Catherine, we're going to hear more from close in to Red Lake, but give us your big view. You've looked at this nationally. Are we now just destined or doomed to see this repeated again and again? Is it going to be every year or two there's a rampage somewhere and the death list of 10 or a dozen, is just now part of our permanent landscape?
Well, of course, we all hope that's not the case. These events do often happen in clusters, though, because the copycat element is there. The national media attention drawn to these cases is a real double-edged sword. On the one hand, it provides exactly the template of attention and glorification, if you will, to the shooter, and that will attract other kids who are looking for glory and an anti-hero status. However, if the media did not alert people to the fact that this happens, then when kids hear threats, and they always do because the shooters always talk about what they're about to do in advance, they wouldn't come forward. And I think enough time had elapsed since Columbine. After all, it's been 6 years. Kids who are 14 years old at Red Lake High School today were 8 years old when Columbine happened. And I think they didn't know that this was a possible scenario in the same way that before Columbine, most kids didn't know. So our best bet lies in finding comfortable ways for kids to come forward when they hear these veiled threats, because they always will. School shooters are looking to pique people's attention, so they don't go quietly into the night. They plan in advance. They let people know what they're going to do. And if you can recognize it for what it is and come forward to an adult, that is really our best bet. If we don't keep it alive in front of kids that this is a possible scenario, then we may well face more of these tragedies.
Jack Beatty, can't ignore it, but every time we talk about it, we fear that somehow it may be perpetuated. Do you see a perpetual new element in the American life, the American landscape here?
Well, what I see is a politics of gun violence that sustains this. The lobby, the National Rifle Association. You know, how powerful is that lobby? Well, in 1994, the Democrats passed a bill banning assault rifles. Why do they do that? Because a man went berserk in California and massacred kids in a schoolyard. You'd think a ban on assault rifles would be something Americans would be for. Not so. The Democrats lost 51 seats, and many people think that was one of the main reasons why, because the NRA ran against them by demagoguing that into a, you know, plot to take away people's guns. Mm-hmm. How powerful is the NRA? Just in the last couple of years, Congress has let the assault weapon ban lapse. They've limited law enforcement investigation of suspected gun sellers. They have mandated the destruction of records of gun sales. Now, Congress is debating a bill that would immunize gun dealers who sell guns to kids, to terrorists, who knows, from prosecution, including a Belgian company that sells a pistol that can shoot a bullet through a policeman's vest. And you know, how easy is it to get these guns? Well, according to the GEO, dozens of suspected terrorists last year purchased guns in the United States. Guns are the, if you will, epidemic factor in all of these things. If the kids didn't have the guns, they'd have to do something else with their violence. You can't do anything about human nature. By God, we should be able finally to do something about guns.
But Jack, let me ask you this. Jeff Weiss's grandfather was a policeman. It was his grandfather's pistol and shotgun that he took to school. Policemen are always going to have guns. Are you saying that, well, how does that factor in? There would have been guns there no matter what the law was.
Oh, well, I'm, you know, sure. I mean, I'm not, but he did have,
There was a pistol to begin at 22.
He had a pistol that he killed his grandfather with.
Yes.
Well, all right. He had the pistol.
There it starts.
Yesterday in Windsor, Vermont, a young man was arrested with a 22. He was going to kill the parents of his girlfriend. Where did he get the pistol? You know, I mean, the man from Mars would come down and say, wait a minute, you can't change human nature, but by God, how can you let this lobby do this year after year after year?
Floating in an ocean of guns. I want to turn now to Bemidji, Minnesota again. Kent Smith joins us there. He's professor of Indian Studies at Bemidji State University, located at the center of three reservations, the White Earth, the Leech Lake, and the Red Lake. Kent Smith, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
So how are you looking at this? Is there, you know the local culture well, we all know the national culture. Where do you see the balance in what's played out here this week?
Well, my son and stepson both attended Red Lake High School, my younger boy graduating in 95. I was fortunate enough to live there in the mid-1980s until we moved back to Bemidji.
So you and your son are both members of the Chippewa.
Yes. We're all Chippewa. Red Lake is separate, however, and that is in a historical context, having to do with the redistribution of land under the Dawes Allotment Act, and more specifically the Nelson Act of 1889, which addressed Minnesota in particular.
What's the implication of that? What are the consequences?
Well, my reservation, White Earth, was allotted, and at the end, there was 4% of our land base remained. Red Lake, on the other hand, listened to their traditional chiefs, their hereditary chiefs, who are still in place. I think one yet to be named at the moment, but because they listened to their elders and because they valued their land so greatly, they were able to hang on to their their reservation. The act was specifically addressed to Minnesota because Red Lake was at the time was holding on to 13 million acres or so, and
so they've got a big abundant reservation. You would think that would create stability, not the opposite.
Well, there is a stability at Red Lake. I think in some ways it's quite peaceful, at least from my experience. I think Red Lake takes a great deal of strength from its land and its lakes. It provided subsistence to them, where my reservation, people had to leave.
Let me ask you about Jeff Weiss in particular and his alleged postings on this neo-Nazi website where he's supposed to have written, and I wonder how you were responding to this, as a result of cultural dominance and interracial mixing, there are barely any full-blooded natives left. And he put this up as a bitter complaint. Is this just one young man's view of the world? Is this an issue in the Red Lake community, in the Minnesota Native American communities?
Well, yes. There's a nostalgia for the full bloods, and he's. I don't have a number for you, but the number of full bloods is really rather small. And cultural purity. Well, we're. You know, because of our history and lands being taken and lands being redistributed and losing our livelihood under treaty where we could no longer hunt and fish freely through the forest, as Chairman Jourdain, or formerly my student, who I referred to as Buck, Jourdain, said it the other day, we need to reconnect with our identity. And further, I think the difficulty is we have to redefine our identity because we're no longer hunters and gatherers. certainly there's a great deal of subsistence on most of the reservations.
But can you imagine that loss of identity being so painful that it might help drive a young man to this act? Or does that seem a leap to make that connection?
No, absolutely. There are many different theories about Indians and alcohol, for example. One of those being the cultural disconnect. You know, we don't have anything else. We turn to alcohol because it's easy. In some ways, almost defining to some people. You know, this is an Indian thing to do.
Ken Smith, stand by. And Catherine Newman in New York City, Jack Beatty. We're talking tonight about Red Lake, Mourning Its Dead, and the nation struggling to make sense of school shootings. You can join the conversation. What can be done to stop more Columbines, more Red Lakes? What do you see in this boy, this young man, Jeff Weiss, and his story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Red Lake, Mourning Its Dead today, and the whole nation struggling to make sense of school shootings. My guest tonight from northern Minnesota at Bemidji State University, member of the Chippewa tribe, Kent Smith, is with us. He's professor of Indian Studies at Bemidji State University. From New York City, Catherine Newman joins us, professor of sociology at Princeton University, author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. What is, sadly, all-American here? And what might be particular to the reservation, to the rage of a young Native American? What do you make of an Indian teenager turning to a neo-Nazi website to bemoan a loss of racial purity? And where does this kind of killing end? How does it end? What is the well of this hopelessness and rage? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ray is calling from New York City. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Yes. I would like to comment on the way the issue is communicated to the public. I don't know that one can analyze any particular person without a lot more knowledge. But I've followed these issues for about 20 years now.
Which issues do you mean, Ray?
Pardon?
What issues in particular do you mean?
I'll tell you the issues. Mm-hmm. First place, the public often says, or people who know the kid, they say, oh, he was such a good kid. He never said a word. He was so quiet. And now, as if that were a clue to goodness. In fact, that would be precisely the kind of concern a teacher would not have any concern with, because the person was not a troublemaker. But that would that's one kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second kind of thing is the fact that there are sometimes very religious kids who think only in terms of good and evil, who are also very quiet and withdrawn, can get triggered.
So what's your prescription here, Ray?
Well, that's the thing. There's no easy prescription, but I think that if you look at liberal families where there's a lot of fluidity in the conversation, you rarely find this kind of sudden outburst, because the outbursts are allowed and they're not labeled negatively. So one serious thing that teachers could do on the ground level, so to speak, is to essentially be worried not about those who talk and express themselves and even out unruly, but those who appear to be withdrawn, quiet and silent, and you never know what's going on.
And given maybe to a black and white view of the world. Ray, thanks for your call. Catherine Newman, let me put that to you. You've looked at lots of data here. Ray, suggesting that if they're quiet, pay attention, and also that there may be a liberal conservative political divide and propensity to this. Do you see anything like that?
No, I don't. I don't think there's any particular pattern to family life that generates this, although we do see some families that are terribly dysfunctional. We see families that are regarded as the happiest, most stable in the community. There's virtually no pattern to that. Where I do agree with Ray is that our disciplinary procedures, our radar screen, if you will, is attuned to the squeaky wheel.
Mm-hmm.
We don't pay a lot of attention to the kid who's flying under that radar screen. And typically, school shooters are kids who have minor disciplinary records that we don't track. And often have a sort of Jekyll and Hyde-like character. For example, Mitchell Johnson, one of the shooters in the Jonesboro case that I studied, 2 months before his outburst, his teacher sent a note to his mother saying, "Mitchell Johnson is the sweetest, kindest, most wonderful child. You must be so proud of him." That's because the Mitchell Johnson the teacher saw was invariably polite, remorseful if he made a mistake. But the Mitchell Johnson his peers saw was angry, belligerent, and talking about school shooting.
And it happened. Ann is calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that it's ridiculous and almost offensive for us as adults to be talking about access to guns and what might be going on in the home life when we spend an enormous amount of time ignoring the culture that the kids are being allowed to create, especially in schools.
What do you mean exactly, Ann? What culture?
Well, I work with lesbian, gay, bi-attractional, and transgendered youth.
Okay.
And they often suffer some of the same isolations that we're talking about with kids who are end up being shooters.
The failed joiner, marginalized kids.
Right. And the issue is that the culture that's being allowed to be created in schools. We're not teaching kids to be compassionate. We're not setting standards that say we don't harass according to bias, according to race, religion, attractional orientation. We don't have a culture in which rejection is acceptable. We spend a lot of time working on politics and test scores, but the culture that's being created, especially in schools these days, is one that teachers and principals and all of us are ignoring the fact that kids are growing up learning or being allowed to create a culture of rejection and cruelty and impolite and lack of compassion.
And do you really think that the opposite of that can be taught in the schools, Ann?
Yes, absolutely. It can absolutely be taught. It can be taught by refusing to accept when you hear someone walking down the hallway using biased harassment.
Yeah, we've got it. Ann, thanks for your call. Kent Smith, take us into Red Lake and the kind of culture, the training, the moral support, or even moral training there. Do you imagine that Jeff Weiss lived in a kind of vacuum of support in those terms? Any different from, I don't know, a teenager in Columbine?
I think that, my wife and I have been talking about this, and he suffered a lot of losses.
Yes, he did.
With his father and his mother, and being shuffled here and there, and living in the city, and then coming home, and it's difficult to come back, it's hard to fit, and especially how to deal with all of this stuff. And he had access to guns, of course, and he, and more perhaps importantly, he had an outlet, the neo-Nazi, the goth, the music, which is a little bit different from what we had. I went to school in the morning. I went hunting first. We were out the break of day hunting ducks, and I change my clothes and I go to school. And
communing with nature, not with the web.
Not with a whip, and I'd go to school, and I was tormented. There were bullies, and it was tough being Indian in a predominantly white school. So in his culture, coming home to Red Lake, coming home to any reservation after you've been away a while is a very difficult thing to do.
Why exactly? Why?
Well, I'm not quite sure why. I hear from my students all the time that it's difficult to get a job. It's difficult to deal with the scholarship officer. You're an outsider.
But when you come back to the reservation, you're not an outsider, and he didn't need a job exactly.
Are.
You are? Because you've been away?
I left for 15 years. I went away to college.
I
came back 15 years later to Bemidji.
Mm-hmm.
And people looked at me a little oddly. But then I wasn't a burden on the reservation. I wasn't looking for a job. I wasn't looking for housing. So I had a good job at Bemidji, and so I was accepted. But
he was coming back from some time in the city, and that could have put a different feeling on him as well.
Yeah, perhaps so. Perhaps so. Reentry might have been tough for him, as it has for students that I talk to. at college.
Let me get another call here, if I may, Kent. Sure. Brooke is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Brooke, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to follow up on Dr. Newman's point about students not being aware of what to take seriously because it's been so long since Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
As a teacher, I spend, you know, hours every single day and a lot of instances more time with my kids than their parents do. And I am finding that parents and administrators are not listening to teachers when they say, there's nothing I can really put my finger on. He's not a distance problem yet, but something is wrong in this with this kid's life, and we need to pay closer attention. I'd just like to know if Dr. Newman has any experience in that area or what her research tells us about that.
Brooke, we've got it, and thank you. Catherine Newman, as you said, in this case, clearly antenna were up. He was out of school, being homeschooled by order of the school. But the caller asks, in that vague area where something's off, are teachers empowered? Are they educated to do something? Do they have the power to make something happen?
I think it's extremely difficult for teachers who are not mental health professionals and often feel somewhat resentful of the number of tasks we place on their backs. We ask them to teach our kids morals, driver's education, sex education, pass tests. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are loading an incredible amount of responsibility on the backs of the one single institution through which our children pass. And it is difficult for them because they're not trained to be mental health coordinators. And, in fact, the resources we provide in schools for counseling are hopelessly overtaxed and getting worse all the time. I do think there is something to be said for providing teachers with the opportunity to pool their observations. In schools that practice, for example, team teaching, usually for pedagogical reasons that have nothing to do with violence, a teacher who observes an essay like the ones Jeff turned in or the ones I saw in my school shooting cases can turn to another teacher who might have seen a kid's handwriting slide off the scale or witness some sort of tantrum or episode. But most of the time what we see are teachers who see these kids for 50 minutes a day and don't have a structured opportunity to share their observations. So we've got piecemeal information of trouble building up that is never put together into a single pattern. We have incidents that occur in eighth grade. By the time the kid moves to ninth grade, the disciplinary records have been shredded, and we can't see a paper trail.
And there comes the trouble. Catherine, we've just got a few seconds. If you could wave a wand and change one thing in this whole mix to help on this problem, what would it be?
It would be to find ways, and we have many suggestions, to make it easier for kids to come forward when they hear the threats, because they are always there, and that is our best bet for interdicting these terrible tragedies as they unfold.
The children, no. Catherine Newman at Princeton University, author of Rampage, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Kent Smith, professor of Indian Studies at Bemidji State University in Bemidji, Minnesota, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jack, thanks to you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
In a moment, a former Red Lake High School teacher mourns the tragedy in his community. This is On Point. For former Red Lake High School teacher Kent Nerburn, word of this week's school shooting has been especially tough. Nerburn got the news in Oxford, England, where he is supervising a group of students from nearby Bemidji State University who are traveling around Europe. Cut off from the tribe he loves, he has been unable to reach out and share in its grief, but he does have some advice for Americans who are watching news coverage of the shooting. In this radio diary, Kent Nerburn warns that the national media, which has descended on the reservation, may not be giving an accurate or complete picture of the Red Lake Nation.
I awoke Tuesday morning to the leafy richness of an Oxford University spring day, far from the cold confines of my northern Minnesota home. I am here across the pond with a group of students from a small Minnesota university who are having their lives changed by a series of brilliant lectures in a city of timeless civility. But as I sit here, another group of students from the Red Lake Reservation near my hometown in Bemidji, Minnesota, are also having their lives changed. But those changes are coming at the hand of a student who walked through the hallways of a high school where I once taught and aimed a gun at the teachers with whom I once worked and the children of parents with whom I have shared tables and friendship. It is a sad and tragic story, made all the more poignant by my knowledge of the people, the reservation, and the land on which this all took place. I wish there was something I could do. But I cannot reach across to my friends. I cannot share the grief of the Red Lake community that I have grown to know and love. What I can do is reach out to those of you in your cities and homes and ask you to watch. Watch as the journalists and TV reporters fly out from their home cities, land in Minneapolis, catch a commuter flight to the small airport in the forests of Bemidji, and drive their rental cars 30 miles north through the pine and popple to the Red Lake Reservation. Watch them as they go to the small convenience store, interview a few folks, and push their way as near as possible to the school building that sits on the gravel parking area near the edge of the Great Northern Lake that gives the reservation its name. Watch them go into the tribal offices, try to interview the tribal chairman, a young man with a dream of making his reservation a better place, and then scurry back on the dark country roads to their hotels in Bemidji, where they can issue dispatches about a student caught in a culture of poverty and hopelessness on a rural reservation. It will all be quite earnest and at least partially true, but it will not get to the heart of the matter. It will not show the love and sense of family that is at the core of the reservation. Nor will it reveal the unique sense of grief that fills a culture where the drum is the metaphor for community. When the drumhead is struck in one place, the whole membrane shudders and the sound reverberates everywhere. What it will do, I'm afraid, is reduce this tragedy to a sociological event. Rural reservation is carte blanche for journalistic speculation about social problems and cultural hopelessness. So watch to see if that is what this story becomes, and wonder why the same story in the wealthy suburbs of Denver did not immediately become fallow ground for sociological speculation about wealth, anomie, and fundamentalist Christianity gone awry. This Red Lake story is hidden beneath two layers of mythology and misunderstanding that pervade contemporary American culture, rural and Indian reservation. In each lies a series of expectations and misconceptions that obscures the truth of events and makes what takes place there something other than the workaday affairs of our urban and suburban lives. Watch now and see if that mythology and misunderstanding obscures the truth. I know Red Lake. I know those kids. They are just like my students asleep in their beds here at Oxford, just like your children brushing their teeth and packing up their books down the hall. It was Sitting Bull, the great Lakota chief, who said it best. Come, let us put our minds together to see what kind of life we can create for our children. Those children in Red Lake are your children. Hear their cries and the cries of their parents as if they were your own.
Kent Nerburn is a former teacher at Red Lake High School, where this week's deadly shooting took place. He's the author of several books on Native American culture, including Neither Wolf Nor Dog, On Forgotten Roads with an Indian Elder. To read more of his writings, visit our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.